Hello and welcome again to Season 3 of What I Did Next from A&T Media. I'm Malak Fouad, your host. This show focuses on people's personal and professional crossroads and looks at those trajectories from key pivot points. My guests are multilingual, multicultural, and they're either from the Middle East or are connected to the region in some way. They're industry leaders, they're curious and passionate about the world around them, and they aim to leave their mark in some way. Today, I'm delighted to welcome Dr. Ahmed Haykel to the show. To many in the business community across the Middle East, Ahmed Haykel is a household name, but things could have been very different. After getting his PhD in 1992 from Stanford in industrial engineering and management, Ahmed wanted to become a university professor. As the son of the renowned confidant of Egyptian President Gamal Abdel Nasser, Mohammed Hassanin Haykel, academia seemed like a good fit for Ahmed. Today, Ahmed is chairman and CEO of Alha Holdings, an investment company focusing on industries including energy, cement, agri-foods, transportation and logistics, and mining. Some key companies under the Alha umbrella include the Egyptian Refining Company, ERC, ASIC Holdings, Taqa Arabia, and Dina Farms. Ahmed talks to me about the major ups and downs at the firm and the difficult period between the 2008 financial crash as well as the 2011 uprising. Describing these major pivots, he explains how Alha was able to eventually complete the building of ERC against all odds. Prior to founding Alha Holdings in 2004, Ahmed was an integral part of the rise and dominance of EFG Hermes in the banking world. He joined the fledgling boutique financial consultancy in 1992 and went on to hold every major position at the bank, including being executive board member and managing director of EFG Holding. There's no doubt that Ahmed can be a polarizing figure. Is he a gambler or is he a visionary? He can see the big picture and has been successful on numerous occasions in anticipating where the business zeitgeist will be. However, such high risk-taking can also lead to major fails. He talks to me candidly about all of these. Today we see Ahmed in a more reflective phase, concerned with issues of consolidation and deciding that his high-stakes days are behind him. The man I met was thoughtful, pensive, and a person who was keen to look back at the trajectory of his career and life. We start our discussion today with our icebreaker questions. The first question is based on the Malcolm Gladwell book, The Tipping Point. I asked Ahmed what personality type from the book he most associates with, a connector, a salesman, or a maven.
I think all three. All three because I have the capability of passing from what happens at the global economy to what happens at the local economy, to what happens in local industries and what happens on the ground. So, and people tell me I'm a good salesperson, so I'm able to convince people relatively conceptually well.
My knowledge of you is that, of course, you have a strong academic background. And it would seem to me that you'd fit quite comfortably in the maven category, which is an information specialist. Are you a bit nerdy about information? Do you like to gather information?
Yeah, I gather a lot of information. With me, there is a conceptual framework that, and I put in the data points, I adjust the data points in my mind. I gather a lot of information. You can ask me every day about the price of tomato, the price of cucumber. You can ask me about the price of wheat. You can ask me about the price of corn. You can ask me the price of oil. You can ask me about interest rates. You can ask me about balance sheet of the Federal Reserves. So I can go from ultra top to ultra bottom.
High to low. So it would seem to me that you fit more the maven and salesman category, maybe not the connector, which is a little bit more of a networker, bringing people together.
Whenever I have an idea of a business, I just do it. If I get an idea, and you don't get ideas by just sitting in the office or there, you have to be in markets, you have to know the lay of the land in order to identify a business opportunity. I don't believe people sitting in their offices and then suddenly there is a godsend idea that comes down from high above.
You need to be connected.
Because you get a lot of those ideas from talking to people, not necessarily from people, but talking to people, and suddenly there is something that comes out.
Yeah. So our second question, Ahmed, is about social media. And this is a question that has surprised me in the way people have answered it. So either people are very black and white about it, they either love it or they hate it, or in one particular case, one of my guests is not on any social media. Where do you stand on Twitter and Instagram?
I neither have a Twitter account nor an Instagram account nor a Facebook account, so I'm not on those platforms.
At all?
At all. Mm. I do a lot of YouTube.
What do you watch on YouTube?
A variety of things, from fishing I'm an avid fisherman, from ballroom dancing, from science, from nutrition, a very varied, of course, businesses, news, etc.
Now, you know that the podcast focuses on pivot points, positively and negatively, professionally and personally. We all have these moments in our lives. I'd like to talk about your childhood. You grew up in a very prominent family, a relatively public family in the sense that your father, Hassanein Haykel, was obviously very well known in Egypt and in the Middle East and beyond. And I wanted to get a sense from you the kind of childhood you had, and what it was like to have a father like that, and how you look back on your childhood.
I had a very happy childhood, punctuated by some events that were quite difficult. I had a very, very, very good relationship with my father. We spent a lot of time together. It also helped that we both did the same sport, which is golf. So we spent an enormous, in golf you walk leisurely for a couple of hours, half an hour before in the car and half an hour later. So we spent a lot of time together, and I used to go with him to golf every day at 6:30 in the morning, before school. We spent an enormous amount of time together. He was a fantastic man. He was very, very cultured. He was very generous with his time, with his information. At a later stage, we became very good friends. During the last 10 years of his life, we spent an enormous amount of time. I would go visit him every day. Probably this is why I felt that I did everything and I was next to him till the last moment. So that was very comforting. But beyond that, he was a very cultured man. He tried to introduce us to classical music. He failed. He tried to introduce us to poetry. He had this gift of memorizing a lot of poems. And, during the golf, he would say, listen to this poem. And he would start.
He would recite it for you.
He would recite it for me and,
But, you say that it didn't have an impact, the love of classical music. But when you learn or when you share a parent's love of something, it rubs off on you.
No. I remember vividly that he tried to take us to a concert in Florence in 1977. And there was a big conductor playing, I think it was Mutti, but I'm not sure. And Hassan and I were sitting next to each other, and the guy started to play with his baton, and Hassan and I went, totally giggles, and we could not stop. And then they had to separate us, and the people in front of us and the people in the back were saying, who are those? I was 17 at the time. Hassan was 11.
But tell me a little bit more about when you were growing up. Were you aware of what his work was? Were you aware of his position in the country?
No, that's the nice part about it is that I was born in 1961. Until 1974, he was he had a position in Al Ahram, etc. But beyond that, he got fired from Al Ahram in 1974. By the time we were aware, those were the difficult years. Those were the years where every time President Sadat would come in a public address, he would attack him by name. So we saw the difficult parts. We did not see the...
And what was that like to hear your father being attacked like that?
Not comfortable.
And how did he deal with it? Because if he dealt with it well, then it would transcend to you.
No. He had a certain view and he did not want to change his views. And he paid the price. He paid the price, but he also got rewarded for it. Because, you know, at the same point in time when he was fired from Al Ahram, he started writing books and our... fortune changed.
He was earning more.
He was earning
more. So that was his pivot.
that was absolutely one of his pivots.
Yeah. And how often would you consult him for advice over the years for your work? Would you turn to him?
No work.
Nothing
we never, about work. Very little work because he wanted to be able to say his views while us pursuing our own businesses. You know, in third world countries, it's very easy to get retribution on one's kids. So it was, we always kept it separate, what we were doing and what he was saying. Sometimes, obviously, he caused us a lot of problems, but that was part of, you know. We were very, 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 very close. I used to enjoy being with him tremendously. He was probably my best friend.
It's a real honor, I think, when you have that that relationship and you're able to look back and say that. It's not everyone who can say that, but it's a huge blessing, I find.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I would hope that my relationship with my kids can be similar to what I had with him. I try to leave them all the space to develop at an earlier stage. Obviously, when kids are very young, you know, there is a disciplinary phase, and then after that, you know, there is another phase where you watch from afar, your supervisory role, and then hopefully you become a role model at a later point.
And now it's a nice age because your children are adults. You have two boys married. It's a different phase, and
I am truly blessed with my wife. I am blessed with my three kids, Mansour, Taimur, and Nadia, and my two daughter-in-laws who are fantastic daughter-in-laws. And I am very grateful for my kids to have chosen fantastic wives. Mm.
Let's move a little bit, Sheikh Ahmed, please, to look at your education. Specifically, I'm interested in the fact that you are an engineer by training. And that you did a master's and a PhD at Stanford. This would have been at what state? What are the years that you were in California?
I was in California starting August 87 till May of 92.
And what was that experience like? I'm not...
Phenomenal. Very, very rich.
Why?
For three reasons. Obviously, when you go abroad, you're challenged in your basic ideas. You know, clash of ideas is quite important for you to reach somewhere that is comfortable for you.
Second, allows you to shape your thinking.
Your thinking and your views of the world. Obviously, for as far as Stanford is concerned, it's the hub of Silicon Valley and you know, it certainly had a huge influence on my entrepreneurship ideas, how to develop, et cetera, et cetera. Because here in Egypt, you study specialize very early, and I did my university years in Cairo University, so I only studied engineering, and I was not exposed to liberal education. And so for the first year, on top of my normal studies, I would go and do courses in sociology, psychology, law, business school. I did one in psychology department. My best class at Stanford was a class on cognitive psychology.
And I think that this whole foundational interest that you had, this interest in psychology, do you feel that it infuses how you approach your work?
Absolutely. You know, it's about how people make attributions, cognition, how you use certain heuristics to form certain ideas. So if I tell you, for example, three of those heuristics are availability, representatives, and anchoring. Mm-hmm. So if I ask you a question, how many countries do you think are in Africa? 30? If I ask you the question, how many countries do you think are in Africa? 60? You will come up with a different answer, because you will move from the anchor that I gave you on. So 60, if you think this is too much, you will go 55. If you 30, you'll go to 40. So this is very well-known phenomenon in how people negotiate.
Do you consciously use these formulas or these
tactics? I don't know whether I constantly use them or not.
But you feel that this knowledge has helped you in negotiations?
Of course.
Yeah. Interesting. You were planning on returning to Egypt and working in academia at Cairo University as a teacher, as a professor. But obviously the Stanford experience added another desire in you.
When I came back in 1992, I had no idea of what I wanted to do.
And were at this point, how old were you?
I was 31. So that's very late.
It's late
to start a career
and to still be uncertain about your direction.
I had no clue of what I wanted to do, and Dr. Taimur, the founder of EFG and a professional mentor of mine,
and an uncle kidnapped
me 3 days into my return to Egypt, and he told me, you know, you should come and work for EFG. So I said, okay, let us try. And EFG, there were a lot of pivots. You know, there are a lot of pivots within the EFG, good and bad.
I also think the fact that you came in more or less at the ground level when the company was starting, and you're coming from a dynamic environment like Stanford, you must have arrived here with so many ideas and wanting to...
Not true.
No?
I had no... It developed during the first year. The first turning point at EFG was a meeting that I had with Dr. Taimur. I was going on a private trip to London, and he told me this guy from Lehman Brothers came in. His name is Daniel Smoller. Try to meet him during your trip to London. I must have impressed him, because he told me, Ahmed, I am coming to Egypt with three very large investors. Please arrange the trip for us. Those investors, I remember vividly. One is called John Leggett, one is called Tom Trimbert, and one is called Arminio Fraga. Arminio Fraga was working for Soros. They came to Egypt, and I was in the same car as Arminio for a very long period of time, and we became friends. At the end, he told me, Ahmed, you need to transform EFG into an investment bank.
And at the time, were there investment banks in
no,
Egypt? There were not.
No.
There were not.
At that point in time,
it was purely commercial banking in Egypt.
I remember I went to my father, I said, I want to, you know, investment bank. He said, what's an investment bank? I said, brokerage, asset management. He said, broker? My son becoming a broker, okay. So it was.
But yet in the US and in Europe, it was a very prestigious career.
I don't know about that, but it was a more accepted
story.
I went the following day, I went to Dr. Taimur, said we need to turn EFG into an investment bank. He told me, no, EFG is an advisory firm and it will remain an advisory firm. Cut a long story short, another big pivot point came in 1995. In 1995, there was a meeting between myself and Hani Tawfiq, then a partner of EFG. I was at that point in time a 10% partner at EFG. I had bought 10% for £100,000. We were looking at a valuation of a company that we had a mandate to value. And I thought the value was 25. He thought the value was £6 million. I thought 25 million. And then at a certain point in time, but he said, this company has no assets. And I told him, yes, but it has very good people. And he said, very good people? What people? You know, he was dismissive a little bit. So I told him, okay, so, but this is what EFG has good people.
He said, an advisory company, yeah. This is where your asset is.
So he told me, yeah, but how much would you value EFG for? I said, how much would you value it for? He told me I would sell my shares 36% for £1 million. Okay, so I had, by sheer coincidence, my checkbook in my pocket. I got it out and I wrote a check for £1 million, which I did not have.
So you used the psychology on him?
No. I did not use the psychology. I did not.
It was pure circumstantial.
He had no intention to sell. I had no intention to buy. But the way he put it, he said, I would sell my shares for £1 million. I said, okay, I bought your shares and I got my check. Here you are. And I have those framed out in the outside. On our way out, I will show you this.
Yeah.
Okay.
So you didn't have the money in the bank.
I did not have the money at the bank. I had just come from Stanford.
Yeah.
I did not have the money.
Yeah. So it was a promise to buy.
No. But he also wanted the approval of Dr. Taimur, right, etc. Yeah. So it was. From there
faith.
On, it was yeah. 2 months until we yeah, executed. Yeah, yeah. But that is what allowed me to bring Hassan back from...
Hassan, your brother.
Hassan, my brother. So that is those shares allowed us to include the first crop of partners mm-hmm. in EFG. Mm-hmm. So we were able to bring Hassan. We were able to get Hassan Abaza to be a partner. We got Ramzi Zaki to be a partner and Mohammed Nabih to be a partner. Mm-hmm.
And then the first, those early years at EFG were quite groundbreaking once you transformed it into this investment bank. What are the highlights of that period for you?
We were having so much fun. We spend an enormous amount of time. I would go open the door of EFG at 8 o'clock. And I would leave probably at 11 at night. So it was very, very, very long hours. It was 80 hours a week. It was
but
grueling.
You can only sustain that if you're in love with what you're doing. Impossible.
Look, yeah. And everybody should encourage their kids to pursue what they love. Because you cannot spend that amount of time in a business unless you really are in love with your business.
This was a bullish and heady time for those investing in the Egyptian economy, and Ahmed's name was synonymous with big wins for EFG. He's also associated with a major fail for the bank, Fanoon, a publishing house and digital media library owning the rights to much of Egypt's cultural output.
The idea is that Egypt has a lot of soft powers. Soft powers, the idea of a soft power is either anything that does not have to do with military or money. So anything you can exert influence in your surrounding that does not involve those two issues.
Yes.
like the power of ideas, the power of arts, the power of sports,
culture,
the power of culture, the power of
tourism.
You have a lot
Absolutely.
Of, you know, managers that you can export, you know, mm-hmm. a lot of mm-hmm. businesses that do business yeah. around, etc. So the idea was to put a lot of that heritage into one house.
And in particular, you were looking at cinema and music.
Cinema, music, and publishing.
Yeah.
So in publishing, we had Naguib Mahfouz, Tawfiq al-Hakim, my father, a lot of people under one house. In music, we had Umm Kulthum, Abd al-Halim, Abd al-Wahhab.
But how did you buy, where did you buy the rights from?
We
from
bought
who?
From the heirs.
From the heirs of these people,
yeah.
Okay.
Or from the companies themselves. And the idea was to monetize those rights digitally.
Mm-hmm.
That was in 1999-2000. And that was too
soon.
Soon, mm. Okay? And we could not sustain that.
And then you obviously offloaded the company.
We
Who
sold
to?
It to Prince Al-Waleed. Mm. And the story of how we got it, we did that deal is one day it will be, but it's a very long version.
But it's was this a very much a project that you took to your heart? Because the idea of culture and the idea of
yeah.
being part of trying to sustain and bring to the next generation the Egyptian word and music and
there was some they were with me. It's always the mix.
Mm.
I'm not motivated only by money, although money is very important because shareholders require money returns. But you also have another element of being useful to society.
And what did your father think of the concept of
Fulun? He said it's dynamite. You don't know who you're dealing with. And,
dynamite in a negative way?
And dynamite in...
Oh, really? I thought you meant dynamite as amazing.
No.
Why?
Let's leave that one.
We'll do that one offline. That's very interesting. I thought he'd be very proud to be able to create a way to sustain all this for the next generation.
The problem is there were too much vested interests.
But the concept must have
appealed. Yeah, the concept is good, yeah. but the problem is,
you will
step on too many vested interests.
Yeah. When we come back, I talk to Ahmed about his leaving EFG and getting started with Ella. We also take a peek into his bucket list, and this may surprise you. That's right after this short break. I wanted to take a minute to tell you about our bonus episodes, available exclusively for subscribers. On each bonus episode, I take a deeper dive into my guests' industries, and I share some extra parts from our conversation. For example, you can find out more about the screenwriting process with acclaimed filmmaker Mo Hefzi, or about the luxury design industry with Monez and Aya Abdelraouf, the sisters behind Ochtin. All of these great stories are only available on our bonus episodes, so subscribe now to unlock this amazing extra content. You can subscribe in Apple Podcasts by clicking the subscribe button or on our website and get instant access to all our bonus episodes with a 2-week free trial. And now, back to the show. I wanted to take a minute to tell you about our bonus episodes, available exclusively for subscribers. On each bonus episode, I take a deeper dive into my guests' industries, and I share some extra parts from our conversation. For example, actor and comedian Rami Youssef told me about his thoughts on cancel culture, and ex-anchor and now author Hela Gorani told me her thoughts on the future of journalism. All of these great stories are only available on our bonus episodes, so subscribe now to unlock this amazing extra content. You can subscribe in Apple Podcasts by clicking the subscribe button or on our website and get instant access to all our bonus episodes with a 2-week free trial. And now, back to the show. Welcome back. I'm Malak Fouad and you're listening to What I Did Next. Today, I'm talking to Ahmed Haykel, a businessman who has been central to many of the ups and downs of the Egyptian economic landscape of the last 25 years. So then you left EFG, Funoon.
I sold Funoon, and I sold Funoon in a very nice way. Return money to shareholders.
And all the material lives on anyway.
Yeah,
which is in a way good. Yeah. In a way important. So tell me what happened next for you. I know that
to form Kala.
Did you have a break or did you
go straight into it? Straight into it.
So you had perhaps already been formulating in your mind another concept?
Yeah. Yeah. I was at the last days in EFG I was the head. I am the one who probably did all four disciplines at EFG. I was head of securities trading, I was head of asset management, I was head of investment banking, I was head of private equity. So private equity, that was the last thing I did. So this was the thing that I...
So that was a natural jumping off point for
that
you.
That was a natural jumping off
point. And tell me about the start of Ella.
We were looking for the first deal. The first deal was an important deal and we were looking for it. We identified it. But it took much longer to close. And at a certain point, Hisham Khazandar came to me, said, you know, is it time to fold? We're not doing the first deal. But we kept at it. And
what
we did
was the first deal?
The first deal was ASIC, yeah. ASIC was one of those deals that will never be repeated. In 2005, we thought that valuations were running very high. We had made very large sums of money, you know, when you start talking about those types, multi-hundreds, millions of dollars, this is a huge, those are huge amounts. We then thought that we could build companies instead of buying companies. And that is a totally different...
It's a different beast.
Skill
yeah.
set.
Yeah, yeah.
And a different beast.
And with the financial crisis of 2008, you were still able to continue with the development of those companies?
Yes. And that was using the firm's own capital. Because at that point in time, co-investors of ours were no longer willing to invest.
Mm-hmm. But at some point, Ahmed, didn't you have to make a decision as to which of those companies you had to put your resources behind
We got them all out of the door. There were a lot of calls within the firm to concentrate on some companies, but we ended up being able to conclude everything until 2000. But then we got extremely unlucky with the timing of the ERC closing.
Before we discuss that, tell me a little bit about ERC. So you and I went on a very interesting day trip together, a field trip. For me, it was a field trip. For you, it was a day at the office where you showed me around the plant and I got to attend a meeting with you there. But explain a little bit the idea behind ERC, why you did it, why you developed it, why you built it. And the ups and downs, because you had all these major problems with it.
The idea is Marwan Al-Arabi's idea. Okay, he came to me one day, he said, I found it. Okay, I found
the Holy Grail.
I found the idea, and he had found a really very, very interesting idea. You know, every single company that you do should have an idea about how you're going to make money, you know. And Marwan had identified that particular point.
Otherwise, it's a dream.
Otherwise, it's just a concept. For your listeners, ERC is a $4.3 billion company.
And
so it's
Egyptian.
Not that you are going to get, you know, we were looking for $5 million
yeah.
or... Okay, we're looking
that
are astronomical by private sector standards. You know, we our loan was $2.3 billion, a huge loan to get without the guarantee of the government. And in February of 2011, the four local banks withdrew their support, and that was $450 million of equity.
Wow.
In the middle of the revolution. Okay. So it was a huge blow at the time, and then on top of that, me Tariq Salah and Marwan, we were banned from travel at that point in time. Also, they accused us of all sorts of misdeeds, and which were totally false. And we were able to clear that by June of 11. So we started anew with a $450 million equity shortfall right at the time where...
You were closing. We were meant to be finishing.
We were meant to be finishing, but then $450 million when there were riots and people getting killed right in front of our offices. So it was a very, very difficult time, and it was a very tumultuous time.
And how did you get through it?
We got through it by taking on more risk than what we should be doing. And we took on more debt than what we should have.
But so you then were able to get loans?
But then we were able also to push through, and at the end getting built. And what you saw last week or 2 weeks ago is something that you should think of as the sheer will and determination of a group of people that took us to there. Now it's a very successful company. It's a fantastic company. It's a very profitable company, but we passed through difficult times.
When we did the tour and I asked you if you would consider building another refinery in Egypt, and you were very quick to answer, no way.
No way.
What did it take out of you, this entire experience, the 2008 crisis followed by the revolution? And did you feel that it was almost like a mission that you had to finish ERC? Did you feel invigorated by it? Were you excited by it, challenged by it? Or were you just trying to get to the finish line?
I was trying to get to the finish line. I would sit here and think, if I go back, I'm 100% finished. If I continue, I'm 95% finished, because I'm not going to reach the other side. It's out of sheer will and determination that we ended up reaching on the other side. Thank God today we are making $3 million a day of profit. So let me not,
it's not a sub
story. It's not a small investment, and we are ending up being rewarded by it.
Yeah.
But it took a huge toll on us.
What did you learn from it? From the experience?
Never start a business until you're fully financed. Because there is the escalation of commitment process that takes place, and you're tempted spending the additional $5 million, $50 million.
And it's incremental.
And at the end, you end up being 7 months pregnant with no possibility of aborting.
I want to shift gears, Ahmed, please, and talk a little bit about some personal aspects. You mentioned that you'd been ill in 2008 and 2013. You had sarcoma, a form of cancer. Tell me a little bit about I don't need details. I don't need you to go into details, but how did it happen in the beginning? How did it also, because I've also had cancer. So for me, it was a very big pivot in my life. How did it change your perspective on life, and how did it make you look at things around you? How did you prioritize things after that?
First, I was diagnosed in February of 2008, 2nd of February 2008. I was on the operating table in Boston on the 7th of February. So 5 days later, I took this decision very, very fast. It was 48 hours.
And you were how old then?
47.
47.
After the operation, immediately I started getting radio, very, very aggressive radio, and very, very aggressive chemo. The sarcoma is very dangerous because it tends to go to the lungs very quickly.
And you were never a smoker?
I was never a smoker. No, but it's not smoking. It's
no,
it's,
but if you had already weakened lungs, yeah, it would have been a problem.
Yeah, maybe.
Yeah.
I did not know the probabilities, etc. So
better.
Exactly.
Much better.
Hassan Haykal came to visit me one day, and he came to me with, to the doctor. And he asked the doctors, can we understand what is the prognosis? He said, the five-year prognosis is less than 30%. And it took me by surprise. I have to admit that I did not know those probabilities. And
you didn't do your, you didn't research.
No, I did not.
You chose on purpose.
I don't know whether I chose or what I let it pass.
Yeah.
Okay. And by the time the after the end of the fifth year, I was going up out to take out my portacath.
You had kept it the whole time for the 5 years?
Believe it or not, I kept it until last year.
Why, Ahmed?
But
out of precaution?
Out of superstition.
Really? How interesting.
Okay.
But it's not bad.
It's not good.
No, but it's discomfort. It's uncomfortable.
It is.
Yeah.
So I in 2013 I was going for my last checkup before I graduate to a full year.
Yes. Okay. Yes.
And the guy came to me in white. He said, "Very strange, but we have a recurrence." Mm. Okay, in the same place. And that is not very normal, etc. So I ended up doing the second.
The same intensity of treatment?
No radiation.
No radiation.
It was just the. And no chemo. I did not take another time, another chemo. No. They just removed it.
I see.
But with much larger margins.
How did it change you?
I am a guy who. Who is takes an even? I live in an even pace. The highs do not get me very high. The lows do not get me very low. You learn with age to have a more even keel about events.
But this is mortality. This is not
a
business deal.
It's time. It's time. Yeah. Hello.
Is that how you approached it?
Yeah, absolutely.
Are you a religious person? Because for me, people who have faith and who are religious in whatever religion, I find that they do much better in situations like this because there are no questions that are being asked. They don't ask questions. They just accept.
I always thought that if it's time, it's time.
That was your attitude.
I did not think about it a lot, but my attitude was that if it's time, it's time.
And did you take more care later, afterwards? Did you become more cautious?
I became much more cautious over the last 2 or 3 years. And that is probably YouTube.
Interesting.
Because I follow tremendously the research coming out of Harvard, Stanford, San Francisco State, regarding longevity, that field of, and how what you could do with trying to improve your probability of, it's not only genetic. Genetics are only one factor, but everybody knows now that intermittent how you eat, intermittent fasting, that sleep is very important, that smoking is a disaster, that you should observe that drinking too much drinking is terrible. Everybody knows now more or less the parameters that exist. So there is more or less now an established...
A standardization to what we should
More standard. Yeah. It's not a... everybody will always push the boundaries of research, but sports is important, outdoors is important. So walking is
good. So you're trying to incorporate these elements in your life.
I try to incorporate. Losing weight, I lost some weight, some reasonable amount of weight over the last 2.5 years. Mm.
You know, there's a theory, I don't necessarily believe it, that stress is a big...
Absolute. Stress is a very important...
Brings cancer.
I don't know about that, but... Yeah,
but there's a theory that there's a lot of people that believe that.
I'm sure it's stress is not good.
Stress is never good.
Stress is never good. as you grow older, extremes are not good.
When you think of yourself, are you a detail person or are you a big picture person?
I used to be a big picture guy. Halas. And I have our the CFO of EFG Hermes at the time, Ramzi Zaki, would come and tell me, look, you stay where you are and don't go into the operation. You think in millions and the operation is with pennies.
Piastres.
Okay, so don't come near my people And I understand what he was telling me.
Someone has to be big picture.
So I was big picture, he was. But now, with what we do, you cannot be, you understand that big picture is not enough. Implementation on the grounds and the pennies and the piastres, and they are extremely important in a variety of businesses that we have. So I have learned to be extremely diligent as far as the picture on the ground. So not enough to be at the big picture, man.
So we've talked a lot about today the risk generally, your career from the beginning. There have been a lot of risks in front of you, risks that you've taken, risks that you have not taken. When you look back, when, you know, just generally, do you consider yourself to be someone with a high level, a high taste for risk?
Used to be on the upper end of the chart. Now, more and more with time and with age and, you need to be more, fear is important. Fear of hurting one's reputation, fear of hurting one's wealth, fear. Although I don't think in terms of, I want to live comfortably, but I don't think in terms of bank accounts. That does not interest me. But fear is an important factor. I used to be fearless, mm-hmm. and that is never a good thing.
Can I ask you something? Because for me, going back to the cancer issue, for me, I developed fears after that. I got phobias about things. That didn't affect you in that way?
Zero.
So in your case, the fear issue is more that with
the
age...
The risk. I don't have... I recognize that I don't have in me the desire or the capability to start anew. Mm-hmm. I pass through a variety of cycles. I lived a very interesting life, but if I have to start from scratch again, now we have maybe 40, 45 companies that are doing well. I am not looking to take on a lot of risks, marginal on the periphery, but today I don't have it in me to start a new cycle.
You're in a maintenance and consolidation phase.
I am in a maintenance and consolidation phase.
Okay, lastly, just for fun, what is on your bucket list?
On my bucket list, I would like ballroom dancing is certainly.
I love this. Tell me about this.
When we went to California in 1987, May and I, we picked up ballroom dancing. And we would go to the YMCA for classes. Probably we went 8 or 9 times. I had taken two dance lessons with Hassan in Zurich.
When you were
Hassan,
children?
When we were...
Teenagers?
Not, teenagers, yeah.
That your mother, of course, insisted
no,
on.
No. It was not related to my mother. I had... we went to St. Moritz a lot. And There is a famous discotheque there called La Volière. La Volière is named after the Shah of Iran. He had the Tawus, and La Volière, he used to go there a lot. Mm-hmm. So they named this disco after him. And so in 1980, I was there and I saw a couple dancing, and it was magical. They were obviously practicing couple, and it was fantastic. And I always wanted to...
What did you like about it? The elegance, the flow?
The elegance, yeah. The elegance. Yeah. So, and the rhythm. So I wanted to... So when we went to California, we started a class. And then my was pregnant, so we stopped. And she decided she does not want to take it up because I'm a lousy dancer. that's what she said.
That's what she said.
She's probably right. I'm a lousy dancer.
But you obviously love it. It's still fun.
I did.
It's fun.
I do love it.
Yeah, yeah.
So probably, you know, hopefully in a year's time, you know, I would be... Probably 10 kilos lighter and more, have more leisure time on my hands.
And being able to move around the dance floor.
And be able to move
But you would may be willing, a willing partner?
No. May is not a willing partner and I don't want to start with her. I want to take classes with a professional dancer.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
No.
I love this story. She can watch you.
She can watch me.
Ahmed? Thank you so much.
Thank you.
What a treat.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'm delighted you are with me.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening today. This episode of What I Did Next was brought to you by ANT Media with me, Malak Fuad, and is co-produced by Chirag Desai. Please remember to follow us on Instagram, Facebook, and on Twitter for updates on the show. Just search for What I Did Next. You can help our show to grow by leaving us a positive review in your favorite podcast player. Our next episode will be in 2 weeks' time, and we hope you can join us then.